Support for WPR comes from Lawrence University in Appleton, a college of arts and sciences and music conservatory, offering a global education featuring research, internships, and study abroad. Lawrence.edu.
Erstwhile on Beta.
You're stepping on my foot. Kind of hurts a little. Thank you. Thank you. And sorry again to ask.
247.
Who finds it? They're definitely looking for porn.
And after I did a ton of research, I decided that with a new electric blanket and proper use, that the risk of fire or shock was extraordinarily low. And boy, was I wrong.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. All of us at Beta hope that you're safe and well during this time. Some of you may be spending this downtime catching up on past shows and films and books you might have been meaning to get around to. So we thought we'd revisit one of the most bingeable shows in recent years, Noah Hawley's FX adaptation of the Coen brothers' Fargo. Also apropos, comedian Hari Kondabolu tells us how he makes difficult subjects funny. And graphic novelist Craig Thompson takes us through how he turned his experience picking ginseng on Wisconsin farms into a comic book. But first, Noah Hawley. He's the man behind one of the most audacious adaptations of all time. Noah transformed the Coen brothers' beloved 1996 thriller Fargo into the FX anthology series. The series takes place in the same universe as the film, but carves out its own storytelling territory. We caught up with Noah while he was shooting season 4 to talk about his companion making-of book called Fargo. This is a true story. The book's subtitle plays off the famous declaration that opens the film and each episode of the series.
You know, what I loved about the film and its use of that introduction was that the moment that you say something is real, you open yourself up to randomness and coincidence. You know, when I sat down with the network in pitching this idea to them, I said, we have to figure out what is our Mike Yanagita. Mike Yanagita was the character in the movie who went to high school with Marge and called her up out of the blue, and they had this lunch together, and he told her about the girl from high school that they fell in love, and they got married, and she died of leukemia, and he's just so lonely.
Oh, and then I saw you on the TV, and I remembered, you know, I always liked you.
Well, I always liked you.
I always liked you so much.
So, Mike, should we get together another time, you think?
No, I'm sorry. It's, you know, I shouldn't have done this. I thought we'd have a really terrific time.
It's okay, Mike.
You were such a super lady. And then I've been so lonely.
And then later, you find out that that's a lie, that the woman actually has a restraining order against this guy, and you think, why is this in the movie? Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with the story at all, except on some level, it adds to the truthiness of it, because you think, well, the only reason they put that in is because it actually happened. Mm. You know, it's just part of the real story. So on some level, for me, as I break these stories and figure out what should happen in them, you know, there's a lot of conversations that I have with the writers that I work with where I'll say, you know, that's a great twist, but it's a movie twist. It's what you would see in a movie. I'm looking for those moments of random collision, you know, which is why the show has so many moving pieces on a collision course, is because at that point you really don't know which ones are going to collide and when. And when you do that, you undermine the sort of Western black hat versus white hat tropes that everyone always does.
Mm-hmm. Your book features interviews with many of the actors you worked with over the first three seasons, including Billy Bob Thornton, who played Lorne Malvo in the first season. And during your conversation, Billy Bob said that you managed to make a new thing out of something that was revered and yet keep what the thing was that was revered. How did you manage to pull that off?
No, I don't necessarily know how I did it or hopefully continue to do it. These stories always start with a kind of premise. It's two men meet in an emergency room, and one of them is a very civilized man, and the other is the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
That then fuels questions. Well, who are these men, and what happens next? Or a woman drives home with a man sticking out of her windshield and makes dinner for her husband, and you think, okay, well, who's the guy in the windshield and what happens next? You know, there's a certain degree in which those premises arise, and I think, well, that feels like a Coen Brothers premise, a setup, and then obviously it's all in the execution. You know, I had a lot of conversations very early in going from script to screen with FX in which they tried to remind me that I wasn't making a comedy, and I said, well, I think you were having the wrong conversation because Fargo is really the tension between comedy and tragedy. You know, what I feel goes into that filmmaking approach that Joel and Ethan have is that they do a lot of things that are really funny to them that aren't meant to be comedy. Mm-hmm. So the best example is Javier Bardem's haircut in No Country for Old Men. You know, I know that they cut his hair like that and they laughed at his face for like 30 minutes. But there's nothing funny about it in the movie. It's just this sort of very specific and unsettling detail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Billy Bob also told you that people come up to him all the time and say, my God, that character in Fargo is literally the best character I've ever seen on TV. And they're going beyond saying that Lorne Malvo is the best villain they've ever seen on TV.
You step out of the car, please, sir.
How old's your kid?
I said step out of the car.
Dad, come in. Dad, over.
Let me tell you what's going to happen. Officer Brimley, I'm going to roll my window up, then I'm going to drive away, and you're going to go home to your daughter, and every few years you're going to look at her face and know that you're alive because you chose not to go down a certain road on a certain night, that you chose to walk into the light instead of into the darkness. Do you understand me? Sir, I'm rolling up my window.
It raises the question, what is it that makes Lorne Malvo such a compelling character?
We like Lorne Malvo because we know exactly what he is from the first time that we see him. We hate Lester because when we meet Lester, he's wearing human clothes, and he tricks us into feeling empathy for him, and then he turns out to be a monster of equal proportion, but since he tricked us, we hate him for it. I think there's a really interesting dynamic there in which Billy's character is allowed to be the villain you love to hate, you know, whereas Lester, there's no love there in the end.
Yeah. And wasn't the character of Lorne based on a Richard Matheson story?
There was a Richard Matheson story. That wasn't the inspiration for the character originally, but it was something that I read in the writing of it, and that there was something, because I've been filming all day, I can't remember the name of the story itself, but it was about this man who moves into a suburban community and begins to undermine everyone. I think he steals his neighbor's lawnmower and puts it in a different neighbor's garage, and you know, there's just a sense of sowing chaos and undermining the humanity and civility of his neighbors that seemed playful in the right way. You know, it's the devil with a small D instead of a capital D.
Mm. I think the story's called The Distributor, and I'm a big Matheson fan, but I haven't come across that one. I've got to check that one out. Yeah, and that's the thing that I think you say elsewhere in the book. You talk about he wants to create chaos, and he's not interested in financial gain. Really, he's just kind of this agent of chaos, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's most interesting to him is how far can he push people toward their animal nature. And as we see, you know, late in the season when he runs into Lester again and realizes that Lester has gone farther than anyone he's never pushed, you know, Malvo is willing to sacrifice this long con he's been running for months because this is more interesting to him.
Yeah. You say that there's this idea that conflict equals drama, and everyone tries to put conflict everywhere. And you say you don't really agree with this idea, especially in terms of Fargo. Can you talk a bit about how your belief that there doesn't have to be constant conflict plays out in Fargo?
Well, I think especially in a story in which there's going to be suspense and tension and violence and tragedy, that you need to give the audience some place they feel safe. And a domestic reality, the way that Marge had with her husband. You know, there was never any conflict in that relationship. He brought her Arby's, and, you know, so if it's Patrick Wilson and Kristen Milioti or you know, Molly and her dad, you know, or in season three, really it was Ray and Nikki, you give the audience a place where they can just feel safe and a relationship they root for. And then, of course, what happens is when you put Patrick Wilson in danger, people worry.
Yeah, you say that the best acting you have ever seen happened during the shooting of the last scene of season two. It was a scene with Patrick Wilson and Kirsten Dunst traveling in a car. Can you tell us a bit about this scene and how Patrick and Kirsten made it so powerful with their acting?
And somehow he rolls the bird on its side, and just before it hits the water, he jumps. 6,000 pounds of angry helicopter parts flying all around him. And somehow he makes it.
Part of it was just where we were in the story, which is the fact that, you know, Patrick Wilson, for 9.5 hours of the story, he was Gary Cooper. He didn't say that much. He was a very simple guy, as he says, you know, I've got two pairs of shoes. One in the summer and one for winter. And then when the case is finally closed and he's driving Kirsten to jail, he opens up for the first time. It's a very long monologue about his experience in Vietnam. And, you know, this gets to her, and then she opens up to him about how none of this was supposed to happen. And she knew that there was something more to life than being a wife and a mother, and she just didn't know what it was, but she was about to find it when this guy stepped out into the road. And very focused on her own tragedy, which was that this wasn't supposed to happen to her. And then Patrick says, people are dead, Peggy. And, you know, what happened on Kirsten's face in the next 10 seconds, just the series of thoughts and feelings, like, you know, it's a profound gift for actors to be able to show us everything that they're thinking and feeling.
Yeah. One of the most compelling characters in season three is Nikki Swango, who's portrayed by Mary Elizabeth Winstead. Can you tell me a bit about Nikki?
You know, Mary was such a revelation in that role. And, you know, I mean, I'd seen her work and knew what she was capable of, certainly. But you know, one of the great things about Fargo and these ensembles is that I'm often asking actors to play a range that they don't normally get in a role. So, in other words, there's a romantic relationship, there's a comedic element, there's a dramatic stakes, there's ultimately action that's required, and to move between those elements can be rare for actors in taking on roles. And I just assume if you're talented, you can do it, you can be funny. There's something interesting to the tension of someone we know comedically working dramatically.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, with Nikki, she's on parole, and she's in a relationship with her parole officer, and in a more cynical story, she would be taking advantage of him or conning him, you know, just using him to make her parole easier. And we certainly entertained that idea, but ultimately it felt too cynical to me, and knowing that Ray wasn't going to make it till the end of the season, I felt, well, it's much more meaningful if she really loves him, and they have this, even though they're both criminals, at the end of the day, they have this very innocent kind of love for each other that has no guile to it at all. And the other element was I really wanted her to be a strategist. And, you know, the introduction of bridge as a game in which, you know, it's a hugely complex game with a lot of probability involved of being able to play out, like, you know, if these cards come up and these cards come up. That was the fun of it, was to be able to show her as a strategist when, of course, in her life she'd never really had to strategize about anything, but just the experience of knowing that game reveals so much to us.
Whatever happens, don't let the Swedes force a Trump check again. Babe.
What?
Talk about the Wildcat Regional on Thursday. Top three mixed pairs, we qualify for the Upper Wisconsin Semi-Professional next month, which top three in that, the sport, really opens up for us.
I don't think we can talk about season three without talking a little bit about the villain, VM Varga, who is played by David Thewlis. You describe him as the man who doesn't exist. What do you mean?
You know, what's interesting to me is that I think a lot about Fargo as the line that Marge has at the end of the movie where she says, and here you are, and it's a beautiful day, and for what? A little bit of money.
Hmm.
There's this element about Fargo, which is always about the things that people do for money. And so season two was about the death of the family business and the rise of corporate America. You know, season three was about where we are now with this sort of hidden money moving around the earth, this Panama Papers, offshore accounts, shell companies, all of that, and that V.M. Varga is a kind of Faustian figure who comes to Ewan and basically says, you're doing it wrong. It's not about profit for status. It's about hiding your money. It's about being rich and nobody knows, and that the only thing that matters is your worth.
This is a $200 suit. I wear a secondhand tie, a fly couch. Not because I can't afford first, because I'm smart. So look at you, and look at me, and tell me who's the richer.
I feel like this is a trick question.
There's an accounting coming, Mr. Stussy. And you know I'm right. Mongol hordes descending. What are you doing to insulate yourself and your family? You think you're rich. You've no idea what rich means.
Carrie Coon played Gloria Burgle, the police chief of Eden Valley, Minnesota. And in the third episode of season three, Gloria travels to Los Angeles, and the whole episode takes place there. There's a whole different tone to this episode. Many critics said it was one of the best episodes of the series. Can you talk a bit about this episode and the role that it plays in the arc of season three?
It was an interesting episode, both to write and to make and to edit. There was a lot of conversations with MGM and FX because it was the third hour of the season when we had just gotten to know the characters and we were taking this departure with only Carrie, and Ewan's not in it. None of the other characters are in it. It's really just her journey. And ultimately, it's a story about futility and the fact that she's going to Los Angeles to try to solve her stepfather's murder, which we know she can't because we've seen what happened to him, and it's not in Los Angeles. And, you know, we have this runner with the science fiction novel that apparently he wrote as a younger man, you know, about this android who keeps saying, I can help, and then never helps anybody.
It's too late for me. You must find a way to get word back. Let them know it wasn't all for nothing.
I can help.
And the futility of that feeling ultimately pays off thematically at the end of the season. But in terms of that particular moment in the story, I think the network was very worried that we were completely stopping the momentum of the story that we'd built. And, you know, it was not cheap to go to L.A. and shoot it, so it's an exercise in futility that's also expensive.
Yeah, those are the worst kind.
Which are not words that networks like to hear.
No.
But ultimately, I think it was hugely humanizing for her, A, and then B, there was something fascinating to me about storytelling and the human experience of storytelling, which is that because there was a backstory to her stepfather being there that involved some tension, you know, if I did my job right, about halfway through the episode, the audience was going to think, I think she's going to solve it.
Mm-hmm.
They were going to think that completely irrationally because they knew in their hearts they'd seen what happened to him, and yet it's human nature. When you introduce a mystery, you know, with players and suspects, that immediately the audience goes, oh, that guy did it, you know?
Yeah.
And so I thought it was fascinating for that reason as well.
Fargo is an anthology series that jumps back and forth in time. If you had to live in one of the Fargo universes that you've created, which one would you choose and why?
Well, you know, there's something really fascinating about the period stories in that you sort of have both a dramatic and comedic hindsight. You can tell a story with a straight face about how season two is built around this idea that the electric typewriter is going to be the next big thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's funny to me, but
yeah.
It also leads to so much tragedy. You know, we know that the computer is right around the corner, but for these characters, you know, just plugging in a typewriter is the future. And, you know, there's something about that is, you know, exciting as a filmmaker, certainly. You know, I love all my children equally.
Of course you do. Of course you do. And they're all such very lovable children. Noah Hawley, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Noah Hawley is the creator of the FX TV series Fargo. He's also the author of Fargo, This is a True Story. Find out more about Noah and Fargo at wpr.org/beta.
It was never like a fight in the schoolyard or somebody stealing my lunch money. You know, it was more of a subtle thing. It was being left out of things. It was being made fun of. It was jabs about a poo or curry or whatever, you know, stuff like that.
Comedian Hari Kondabolu joins us to talk about the evolution of his career. That's coming up in a minute. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
People always say I'm obsessed with race. You're obsessed with race. You're obsessed with racism. You can't be obsessed with race in America. There's racist stuff that happens all the time. You can't be saying that I'm obsessed with race and racism in America is like saying I'm obsessed with swimming when I'm drowning. You know what I mean? It's absurd. I'm not the one who's obsessed. This country is obsessed. I hear about the year 2042 all the time on the news. 2042, for those of you who don't know, 2042, apparently, according to census figures, is the year that white people will be the minority in this country, right? White people will be 49% in 2042. And I don't know if there are people in this audience that are upset by this, but don't worry, white people. You were the minority when you came to this country. Things seem to have worked out for you, right?
That's comedian Hari Kondabolu. He's been described as one of the most exciting political comics on the stand-up circuit today. Hari grew up in Queens, New York, as the son of immigrants from India. He's tackled a lot of sensitive issues through his act and films, including the documentary The Problem with Apu, which deals with the controversial Simpsons character. We talked to Hari about his career evolution and how comedy runs in the family.
My mom, definitely, for one, always cracks me up, you know, and I cite her often. Mm-hmm. As being the funniest person. I know my brother, who I have a podcast with, the Kondabolu Brothers podcast, like I am constantly losing it on stage with him.
Mm-hmm.
I love stand-up.
Yeah.
I think stand-up is always my first love, but I don't think I have more fun. I think the thing I do that I have the most fun doing is that.
Can you share an example of your mother's sense of humor?
You know, I talk about this in my act, you know, like one time I texted my mom and I said, Mom, I'm sorry I didn't call you earlier this week. And she texted back, it's okay, it was a relief.
Like, I think about what my mom's been through in this country, right? People saying things like, take that dot off your head, or why are you wearing bed sheets out of the house, or why don't you shut up and make me food? And this is just stuff me and my brother said to her growing up. Now, can you imagine what she dealt with out of the house, the people who didn't love her? For those of you who are groaning right now, my mom approved that joke, so go to hell, all right?
You know, I think a lot of my ability to laugh at painful things comes from her. Like,
yeah.
How do you cope? And humor is such an important coping mechanism.
Oh, absolutely. Would your mother say that you are the funniest person she knows?
I don't think my mom would say that. I mean, I know she thinks I'm funny and we laugh a lot together, but I don't know who she thinks is the funniest. I don't think it's me. And if it was, she would not admit it.
Okay. Yeah. Let's talk about when you were growing up and you were attending public school. How did your classmates treat you?
You know, I was treated all right. I mean, I think I had to deal with, like, a lot of kids, you know, bullying in different ways. I was, you know, a brown kid. I mm-hmm. was, you know, fat. So, you know, you deal with the anxieties that come with that. The cool thing about growing up in a really diverse place is that you don't feel alone. Mm-hmm. The only times you feel alone is, like, when you see media and you realize, oh, I don't exist.
Yeah.
You know? But at the time, you know, I did have many different types of people around me, and I was also in this, like, incredible culture. I mean, New York has a snapping culture. We have a culture where we make fun of each other, where we're quick. And I think certainly that's impacted my humor. Like, I'm certainly a New Yorker in that regard.
Yeah. How would you respond to the bullying when you were bullied? What would you do?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's hard to remember specific instances. You know, it was never like a fight in the schoolyard or somebody stealing my lunch money. You know, it was more of a subtle thing. It was being left out of things. It was being made fun of. It was jabs about a poo or curry or whatever, yeah. You know, it was stuff like that.
Thank you. Come again. Oh, that was a racist Apu joke in Denver. Boulder just went up another notch. Good job. Good job. Thank you. Come again. The best part of that is I have your money, sir, and you don't get it back. That's the best part about this. And the funny thing is, I know you from high school, even though I don't. You're the reason I do comedy, sir. You're the reason I thought to myself, nobody like us exists except this cartoon character. I'm going to show up, and I'm going to be the best comic in the country, and I'm going to make less than I deserve in Denver. I mean, that's how I'm here right now. So it's fine.
You know, one thing I was able to do eventually is that being able to do stand-up comedy, I get to control what I want to say. I get to control how you view me. Like, you can think whatever you think when I walk out on stage, but if you're going to watch the whole show, you're going to see a much more complicated person. So I feel like the ultimate revenge is what I get to do now, which is,
tell,
you know, you can make fun of me, but I'm going to talk about all this stuff for the next 20 or 30 years. I'm going to be able to do it in a much bigger forum.
Yeah. I read an interesting quote from you about the connection between bullying and comedy. You said, quote, there's a lot of things that people find funny that are really just bullying. When people get bullied, there are people that laugh. And I think that is a lot of comedy, end quote. So that raises the question in my mind, since you were a victim of bullying, although maybe not as much as I originally thought, but is this kind of bullying that is found in so much comedy, is that something you're trying to avoid in your stand-up work? Or at least do you try to take a different approach to bullying on stage?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly, you know, I think that the idea of bullying as a kid, you know, as I've gotten older, it becomes a, you know, it becomes a larger thing. It's not just simply bullying, but it's, you know, oppression. You know,
yeah.
Bullying is a certain kind of oppression that people deal with. But, you know, it's about the bigger issues of who is having the harder time and why.
Yeah.
You know, what things are in place where certain people can do certain things and other people cannot. So when I'm on stage, I don't want to make people feel bad. And if I do make people feel bad, you know, I want to know that I did it because I did it with intention.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't want to, you know, have a target. I'm making fun of rich people and how, you know, they spend their money and, you know, the ridiculous things that they do. I don't want, if I annoy or upset a rich person, I'm okay with that. You mm-hmm. can't handle that. You have power. To me, it's about always looking about who has power in a situation and going after that target. First of all, because I think it's right. And secondly, because it's more of a challenge. It's not hard to make fun of people with less. People are mean. You know, I think when people trip, you know, I've laughed when people trip. I don't know why. Weird instinct. Like, that's
because
funny.
It's not you. Yeah.
And I think that's the same kind of instinct of bullying. People laugh because that's not me. Look at that person getting picked on.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to admit it, but I think that's there. And that's easy to me. Like, oh, you're making fun of somebody. All right.
Yeah.
What the harder thing is making fun of the bully.
Absolutely, yeah. But before you started doing stand-up full-time, you earned a graduate degree in human rights from the London School of Economics. And
that's right.
Yeah. How has this experience influenced your comedy? I imagine it's had an impact.
I mean, not really. You know,
no?
I did comedy before I even, you know, had a political, you know, a political viewpoint or, you know, I started doing comedy when I was 16 or 17 years old. And for me, the big thing that changed my perspective and how I wanted to do comedy and had impact was 9/11.
Yes.
Like after 9/11 happened, all of a sudden I'm this being who, you know, is questioning the world. Why are there hate crimes in this country? Why is there such hate, violence, and anger and deportations and detentions? You know, I start looking more into the history of America and start to force myself to be more critical of the things I'm reading and the things I was taught. And that really, more than anything, you know, those experiences and that early education, you know, when I was 18, 19, 20, I think that really is what shaped the kind of art I wanted to make. You know, when I went to grad school, I was already moving in a certain direction with comedy, but I didn't see comedy as a career. I didn't see it as something that would ever pay the bills, and I didn't think I would be given chances.
Why did you not see it as a career? Did you think it was, like, too competitive, or?
No, I didn't see it as a career, mainly because at the time, there weren't that many South Asians on television.
Mm-hmm.
There was the beginning, like, Asif Manvi was on The Daily Show, and that was exciting, and Aziz was starting to come up, and Mindy Kaling, you started to see her a little bit, and those moments made you believe, like, something's going on here, but I'm a stand-up comic, brown stand-up comic, who talks about race critically and immigration and, you know, war. I'm talking about difficult things that make people angry or uncomfortable, so I have two strikes against me right there.
I'm obviously joking, right? Why am I joking? Because white isn't a thing. Race isn't a thing. It's all made up. It's a social construct. It's a way to separate us and destroy us, right? It's not real. White isn't a thing, and we know this, right? There used to be signs in New York that said, no Irish, no blacks, no dogs. The Irish weren't white. The Polish weren't white. The Italians weren't white. The Jews weren't white. It's made up. It's a way to separate us. And you know, is there people of color in this room? You know, when you ask your white friends what their cultural heritage is, they never just say white. No, they give you a math equation. I'm a third German and a fourth Irish and 1/16th Welsh. It's like, damn, Steve, all these years I thought you were just white. My bad. I should have been more sensitive.
Plus, the way I talk, you know, I end up being very, like, as you can see from this interview, I'm very verbose. I explain things. I tend to be long-winded. That's also kind of how I write my jokes. I mean, I enjoy that kind of pseudo-academic style. Like, I'm a cool professor. Like, I have fun playing a version of that character. And so, you know, I don't expect anybody to want to see that. There was no blueprint.
Yeah.
There was no way to, like, you know, mm-hmm. say that this is the way it could be. So, you know, I gave up on the idea. And I knew that going to grad school and being an immigrant rights organizer, which I was in Seattle, like, I felt like that was the best use of my time. The idea that I was able to build a career by stumbling into it, that people found my work up in Seattle, the fact that I got auditions in L.A. and New York, even though I wasn't trying, that gave me a sense of faith that maybe things are changing. And after grad school, it felt like, okay, you know, the door's open. I never thought it would be. I would regret it if I didn't try.
Mm-hmm. By the way, I would disagree with your description of yourself as verbose and long-winded. I would disagree with that. Seriously. But you made a short film in 2006 called Manoj, and you said on social media a few years ago that it was still your favorite thing. Can you tell me a bit about Manoj?
Yeah, I love Manoj. It's a short film. It's about minstrelsy and representation. And this is, you know, well before I made my documentary, The Problem with Apu. But even back then, I tackled those issues, which is also part of the reason with why The Problem with Apu felt kind of old for me.
Right.
I'd been talking about this for 12 years. I didn't want to keep talking about it. But, yeah, I made this documentary about a Indian or maybe Indian-American comic, it's unclear, named Manoj Krishnamurthy. And he uses accents. He's very one-dimensional. He basically willingly plays a caricature on stage, because at the end of the day, are people laughing and are they coming to the shows? And that's all he's concerned with. And I wanted to make a mockumentary about that mindset, and I wanted to contrast that comic with me, Hari Kondabolu. Like, those aren't my values, and this is what I think is funny. And why is it for us, when you're given a certain thing and you're told this is funny, this is normal, when you see another figure appear who does not, like, at all fit into your ideas of that identity, it's confusing. And you can't, you know, it's harder to accept me because you expected Apu.
Yeah.
Or in this case, Manoj Krishnamurthy.
Let me try to clear up some common misperceptions about Indian people. A lot of times people come up to me and say, Manoj, why do Indian people eat monkey brains all the time? And that is just not true. We do not eat monkey brains all the time. Because if you know anything about monkey brains are very, very expensive. You can't just eat them all the time. If I had a dime for every time someone came up to me, asked me if I ate monkey brains, I could actually afford to eat monkey brains.
I don't know what I'm talking about.
He's exploring these stereotypes for his own gain, because he knows that he's going to have a career out of it. People will pay to see this crap. People feel more comfortable laughing at something because, I mean, if there was a white guy saying racist jokes on stage and they put him up, I mean, the club would get tons of angry responses, as they should. But when this guy does it, like, who's going to say anything? People are more comfortable with their racism. They're more comfortable laughing.
You know, I made that as a way to talk about this frustration without having to make a real serious documentary about stuff. And then 12 years later, I make a documentary. But,
yeah,
like, you know, the whole point was, like, let me cover it with this funny short film.
Yeah. So. How did people respond to Manoj?
It was really positive. You know, I thought, you know, this is 2006, so I'm thinking, oh, this thing will go viral. And then at the time, I didn't realize, I guess 12 to 13 minutes is too long to go viral. Something has to be, like, under 2 minutes. So, you know, I really didn't know what kind of life it would have, but it played festivals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's been used in classrooms. I'm really proud of what it's been able to do, you know. I feel like it's a clever way to talk about that issue, and it's something, you know, it was made with under $100. I was young. It was like 23 at the time. I was improvising pretty much the whole script. I love the fact that, like, it was a magic moment. It was a magic 2 days when we filmed all of it, and it just came together perfectly. And I think that thrill, that feeling that, you know, you don't need money to make good art. You know, that's never left me.
Yeah, that's proof of that. Manoj is proof of that. Weren't there people who actually thought, like, didn't realize it was a mockumentary and tried to book Manoj, I think?
Yeah, actually, a few years ago, more than a few years ago, and this is a regret of mine, I got a message, I think it was on YouTube, from somebody at the University of Alaska, and they wanted to book Manoj, and they couldn't find any contact info, and they wanted to know whether I could put them in touch. And initially, I thought it was a joke, but then it became clear, no, they're not joking. They actually want to book this character. They missed the whole point of the thing. And what I should have done is created a fake email address, said Manoj was real, and done the show and had a sequel where my director, Mahadra Jaspi, directed it. Instead, I'm like, I gave it away immediately. No, it's actually, you know, it's not a real cat. I'm, you know, Manoj, you know? Which is foolish. I will always kick myself. Like, it would have been really wonderful for it to come full circle.
Yeah, it would be cool. Next thing you know, someone in Alaska or somewhere else will make a documentary called The Problem with Manoj. Maybe they already are. Yeah. How do you think we were talking earlier about how your stand-up has changed post 9/11. How do you think your stand-up work is going to continue to evolve in the future?
I mean, if you're a good stand-up comic, there should always be some kind of evolution because your life's going to change. You should not, like, rest on your laurels. Whenever I see a stand-up that's doing the same act for 20 years, I find it very disappointing, you know, because even if you've been in the same place, you know, your mind's still been working. And there's a lot of reasons for why people stop writing or whatever. But, like, to me, there's so much growth. You know, I'm not so personal in my stand-up. Most of my stand-up is personal, and my views are personal to me. And I strongly feel certain ways about things. But I want to share more of my story. Like, you know, what did I go through as a human being? What are my major life experiences with family and relationships? Like, these are universal concepts and ideas that connect to people, but also for each person is very different. And that's also the scarier thing to share. When you're sharing a point of view, you know, there's some distance between you and the point of view. When you're sharing something that's personal, it's you. There's no joke to hide behind initially. And so there's a lot of growth I see as a comic. And any comic that says there's no more new directions isn't really trying.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Harry. It was great to talk to you.
Oh, I appreciate it.
Harry Kondabolu is a stand-up comedian, podcast host, filmmaker, and NPR contributor. Find out more at WPR.org/beta.
So the whole reason that we were working in Ginseng is we wanted money for comic books. $1 an hour meant one or one and a half comic books an hour.
Graphic novelist Craig Thompson joins us to talk about his new comic book, Ginseng Roots. That's coming up on Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and you're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Craig Thompson grew up in rural Marathon, Wisconsin. In 2003, he published his graphic memoir, Blankets, about his early years as an adult. Blankets won numerous awards, and The Guardian called it one of the best graphic novels of all time. Now Craig is revisiting his Wisconsin ties again with a new comic book called Ginseng Roots. It's part memoir, part essay, and part travelogue. Craig explains why he wanted to write a comic book for the first time in his career.
But I'd never done anything that was just straight up nonfiction, like more essay-based or journalistic. So that was my first desire. Second desire was to write about plants, because we're living in this age of environmental crisis. What are the stories that the plants themselves have to convey to us? We're very human-centric, egocentric as storytellers and readers. Why does a human always have to be the center of a narrative? Why can't it be an animal or a plant?
Mm-hmm.
So those were the first two objectives. Meditating on what plant I had the most intimate relationship with, I realized I'd spent a decade of my childhood working in ginseng. And then as I started to think about that, I realized how unique and a little bit odd that was, that I grew up in this very small town, rural setting in the middle of Wisconsin.
Marathon, Wisconsin, right?
Yeah, working with this sort of exotic medicinal plant. It's far more recognized in Asia and China than it is here. What are the odds, right?
Yeah.
And so at that point, I'm like, oh, I want to write about ginseng. That's going to be my nonfiction subject to explore in graphic novel form. And I really like the idea of expanding graphic novels so that it's not just superheroes, it's not just fantasy, it's not just YA stories. Why not write a nonfiction essay piece on a subject?
Ginseng Roots is your first serial comic book, which of course means that it's coming out in individual issues. Why did you want to tell the story in this format?
So part of that was midlife crisis. And, you know, when I was young and boisterous, I had a lot of energy for sitting down and drawing hundreds of pages in one go. And now that I'm in my mid-40s, the idea of maybe holding up for the next 6 years is very intimidating. I like the idea of getting it out there as I'm working on it, kind of involving the reader more. And because it's documentary work or journalistic, I feel like it's going to need additional fact-checking eyes. And by putting it out there while it's still malleable, it could be very useful. I might hear from people who correct some of the information in the book or from people who might enhance the information of like, oh, I can tell you more about this subject. And that can lead to future issues or chapters.
So I guess given that, you don't know exactly how many issues this is going to end up being, right?
It's outlined to be 12, and I have those pretty tightly structured. There's an element of improv to it all, too, of like, oh, if something new comes up, that'll be the next issue. You know, I want there to be some flexibility. And I forgot to mention that there is childhood nostalgia involved, too.
As you point out in the first issue, weeding and picking ginseng served as a gateway to comic books for you and your brother Phil, didn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of weird. So the whole reason that we were working in ginseng is we wanted money for comic books. They were paying us $1 an hour when we started. I was 10 years old, and my brother Phil was 7. We'd work 40-hour weeks in the middle of our summers, and we were eager for it because $1 an hour meant one or one and a half comic books an hour, and that seemed fair to us.
Sure.
But as we were doing this menial farm labor, we were just dreaming of the days when we might one day be cartoonists.
And speaking of which, you're collaborating with your younger brother, Phil. Each issue of Ginseng Roots features one or two pages drawn by Phil. Why did you want to include his work?
There's a combination of midlife crisis and childhood nostalgia of like sort of the older I get, the more I sort of trip up on some of my childhood and how it's shaped me. And my brother has become a huge ally in sort of identifying and relating and healing those things, you know?
Mm-hmm.
No one else was as close to all those experiences as him. Yeah, I don't know if that happens for everybody. As your self-awareness grows with age, I mean, you're unpacking more and more childhood stuff. You know, your siblings become allies in that process. But also, like, that's when comics and drawing was the most pure for me, is when we were, like, that age, 10 years old, 7 years old, and just drawing on the same piece of paper together. You know, it was that sort of playful abandon of drawing at that age versus being an old, crusty man who's drawing as their job, their day job. You know, I want to get back to that pure, innocent place of drawing.
Mm-hmm. Picking ginseng isn't an easy thing to do. Can you talk a little bit about the actual process?
Yeah, so there's several processes. And looking back, I actually have to say that my brother and I did more of the easier work in a lot of ways. We did a lot of weed picking. That was our first job because it's a delicate crop. They haven't really created an automatic weeder yet. And these gardens, even in the 80s, were at least, you know, a half acre, an acre, or 2 acres large. And then we would help farmers with rock picking, which was clearing a field of rocks before the crops were planted. In late summer, early fall, there was berry picking or seed picking, where you're just harvesting the seeds from the ginseng, which either go towards growing further crops or selling to other farmers. And then in fall is when the roots start coming out of the ground. And that's a more fun task because it's very social. You get in a crew of 30 to 40 people and you try to do it in a day. Once you've tilled up the ground and pulled the roots out of the soil, you got to get them out of there before the sun comes out. So those are the main tasks we helped with. And it's, of course, you know, a high-risk crop. It turned a lot of farmers into millionaires.
Wow.
But it's very delicate crop, susceptible to disease and rot. And because you're taking at least 3 or 4 years to grow a crop, anything can happen in that time. You could have a crop that's perfect for 3 years, and the fourth year it rots and you don't take anything out of the ground. So it's a pretty high gamble crop.
Yeah. I believe this is only your second book in which you've used color. And you've said that you think black and white is the purest way to express yourself. And yet you use black in this almost pinkish red to great effect in Ginseng Roots. I really was very impressed by that. Why did you decide to use this kind of pinkish red throughout the book?
And hopefully with the second and the further issues, it'll look more like an orange cadmium red. That was the look I was going for. And that's inspired a lot by traditional Chinese art printmaking. There's, of course, Hokusai, who's the Japanese printmaker, who is famous for that wave painting. He released a book, a several volume set encyclopedia, visual encyclopedia, where the term manga came from. Those were woodblock prints that were like a black, a gray, and a reddish-orange ink. And there is something, it seems to be the sweet spot. My preference is towards black and white because it's sort of the closest to the author's handwriting. It's very pure.
Yeah.
But consumers like full color the most. And I think the additional one color is sort of the sweet spot because you can see the calligraphy of the artist's line, but there's a little bit more depth and dimension. You know, you can emphasize things. And actually, I'm finding with further issues, if you combine black and red, you have like a pretty infinite palette of sepia tones too that you can work with. So I'm finding it's almost like doing full color. There's less noise that color might create in the narrative.
That makes perfect sense. And the black and white, I can see why you'd prefer that because for my money, the black and white really shows just your masterful command of lines.
Thank you.
You're probably best known for your autobiographical graphic novel, Blankets, which was first published in 2003. For those of our listeners who aren't familiar with it, can you tell us a little bit about Blankets?
Yeah, so Blankets it's essentially a coming-of-age story about sharing a bed with someone for the first time. When I set out to do the book, I thought it was going to be a kind of innocent romance story, innocent high school romance, where I write about that experience, but it's not really, you know, adult or sexual. It's something more innocent. But then I realized I'd also shared a bed much earlier with my little brother because we shared a bedroom and a bed and you know, all the antics that were involved with that of play and fights and et cetera, and how it nurtured a closeness between us. Meditating on those two different stories, I realized there was a book there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very much about growing up in a small town in rural Wisconsin. It's about my relationship to my family's faith and sort of evangelical Christianity. It's about my relationship to creativity, sort of coming from a working class family.
Yeah, there's a lot going on in it, and it's very powerful. You've said that you want to be vulnerable on paper, and you're certainly very vulnerable in terms of the intimate details you share about yourself in Blankets. How difficult was it for you to reveal so much about yourself in Blankets? Was that something that you had to think about, and gee, I don't know if I should reveal this?
At that time, it wasn't too difficult because it was the beginning of my career, and I didn't have a sense of self-consciousness or audience yet at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think people would see this book. I had only a couple of people in mind when I drew it, and that's still sort of the way I try to write my books, like have an audience of one or two people, as if you're writing a letter to someone. That's what keeps it intimate. So, yeah, I didn't think anyone would see it. I certainly didn't think anyone from my hometown would see it. And that was a nice, naive, innocent space to produce from, which I'll probably never have again because now I'm too much aware of audience.
Mm.
So, yeah, that's shifted. And maybe it's going to be a lot more complicated with Ginseng Roots because now I know there's more eyes on the project.
Does that mean it's kind of a struggle to maintain the intimacy and just imagine just a few readers? Has it become more difficult now in the wake of the success of Blankets?
It definitely is. I had a conversation with a cartoonist friend recently where he thought that doing autobio comics, as we call them, is maybe a cop-out. It's easy. He's like, I feel like that's easy for the artist, but less fun for the reader. And I argued that it's the other way around. I think for the reader, it's really fun to read autobio. I love reading. It's almost like a voyeuristic thing to read other people's personal stories in that form.
Yeah.
But it's a lot of challenges as an author. With Blankets, I found depicting myself was easy enough because I can do whatever I want with myself. I can be as self-deprecating as possible. But there's so many sensitivities around depicting other people. One thing that's helping this new project is it's more journalistic. So it's not really just cobbled together from my memories. I'm going and meeting with these people and recording interviews like we're doing now. Not this professional. I record usually with voice memos on my phone and then transcribe all of that. So they are words coming straight from the people's mouths, and that helps.
Craig Thompson, thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug.
Craig Thompson is an award-winning graphic novelist and the author of the new comic book, Ginseng Roots. You can find out more about Craig and Ginseng Roots at wpr.org/beta. That does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Noah Hawley, Hari Kondabolu, and Craig Thompson. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta podcast via iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment.
All it takes is a phone and an open mind.
Online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta.
Why aren't you calling?
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions. Special thanks to Rob Mentzer.
Very nice, Rob. A sly declaration of new classic status slipped into a list of old safe ones.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
I like the way the world looks from a bicycle. And I guess I'm just looking for someone who feels the same way I do about a bicycle.
Our executive producer, nay, showrunner, is Adam Friedrich.
Don't blame me. I'm not an executive, just a writer.
And of course, much thanks to you. Stay safe out there, Alphas. We hope Beta can make you feel a bit better during these times. We enjoyed making it for you. I'm Doug Gordon.
His favorite movie is books.